Today is Wednesday, January 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump faces one of the greatest tests of his presidency now that Iran has launched ballistic missiles at two Iraqi bases housing U.S. troops.
As long as I'm president of the United States, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon.
We have the latest after the president addressed the nation earlier this morning. In addition, more on Australian wildfires. We'll have all those stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump spoke this morning following an Iranian ballistic missile attack early Wednesday targeting two Iraqi air bases that housed U.S. troops. The attack comes after Iranian leaders threatened to retaliate against the United States for a U.S. airstrike that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
Good morning. I'm pleased to inform you the American people should be extremely grateful and happy. No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases.
During the address, the president also explained why the U.S. took action against the Iranian general.
By removing Soleimani, we have sent a powerful message to terrorists. If you value your own life, you will not threaten the lives of our people. As we continue to evaluate options in response to Iranian aggression, the United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior.
Joining us on the phone is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara. Patsy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So I know this is brand new information about the new sanctions that the United States is going to levy against Iran, but what can you tell us from the White House?
Well, essentially what we heard from the president was a major move in de-escalation. You know, he downplayed the attacks, basically saying the American people should be extremely grateful and happy that no Americans were harmed in the attacks. He announced no military retaliation, only new sanctions, as you have played that soundbite, and also called on Western powers to abandon the Iran nuclear deal and work towards a new one, a deal that he said would make the world a safer, a more peaceful place, and also a deal that allows Iranians to thrive and prosper and take advantage of its potential. So clearly this was a move that was designed to de-escalate tensions. As we know, Pentagon officials have floated the idea that Iran had deliberately missed to avoid casualties, and the fact that no lives were lost in the strikes may have provided room for President Trump to de-escalate. He ended his speech with a call to the people and leaders of Iran, something saying that, you know, he wants them to have a great future, one that they deserve, one of prosperity and harmony with nations of the world, and that the United States is ready to embrace peace with all who seek it.
Has there been any indication from your sources at the White House about when discussions, either with European allies who were signatories on the JCPOA, the Iran deal that the United States withdrew from, may take place since the administration is trying to seek a new deal with Tehran?
No, we don't know. This is all very fresh from the oven. You know, we just the president just finished speaking about 15 minutes ago. So there's going to be a lot of reporting that needs to be done in terms of sussing out whether the president is serious in terms of de-escalation, whether the Iranians will respond as such, and how the European powers will respond to this. We're going to see in the next coming hours how European allies will react to this. My bet is that they will react positively. This is something that the UN Secretary General have also called out for, you know, for all sides to remain calm and work towards a peaceful resolution.
Patsy Wiedekuswara is VOA's White House correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Moments after the attack, VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb relayed the information through her Twitter account. Carla now joins us with the most recent information from the Pentagon. Carla, thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Steve.
So what can you share us about the details of the attack itself?
So the attack started with ballistic missiles, but when it was going on, we really didn't know what was happening and what exactly they were hitting with until we got clarification from defense officials much later on, about an hour later on, that these were indeed missiles coming from Iran. But we heard that Al-Assad was being hit first, and Al-Assad was hit with about 10 ballistic missiles, I'm being told. And then Erbil was also hit with one or two ballistic missiles. They're still trying to sort that out. There were reports that we didn't know if anybody was hurt or not, but initially from the beginning, my sources had been telling me no casualties. These weren't areas where there were American service members. There were still concerns that maybe Iraqis could have been hurt. We didn't have that information at this time, but when the dust settled, so to speak, there were no American casualties and no Iraqi casualties, as President Trump said, and I think that is why he was waiting so long. I know that Pentagon officials, as you saw when you were listening to him speak, behind him was Secretary of Defense Mark Esper and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. They have been there at the White House trying to sort through the potential options, trying to confirm that there were no American casualties. And I think when he was able to do so, that's when he went out to address the American people and the international community.
Iran has come out and said that its ultimate goal politically is to get U.S. forces out of the region. There's been a lot of discussion whether or not there's going to be troop withdrawals from Iraq. There have a lot of been misreporting and false information out there. You reported yesterday that General Milley said that, you know, troops are not leaving Iraq. What do we know about troop movements in the region for U.S. forces?
So, yeah, there's been a lot of reporting out there, but there are not, as far as I know, and as far as the officials have been telling me, there are no troops leaving Kuwait. I know that that was circulating. That's not happening. In fact, troops just arrived into Kuwait in recent days. About 4,000 additional troops just arrived into Kuwait. We've reported that on International Edition. And I am hearing that no troops so far are leaving Iraq. We do know that the Iranian Council of Representatives had a non-binding vote to try to remove U.S. forces from Iraq, but they have not had a binding vote yet. And so the U.S. officials have said on the record that they are not leaving Iraq. They have no intention of leaving Iraq at this point. However, you heard President Trump just say that he wanted NATO to get more involved in the Middle East. This could be an opening for President Donald Trump. The United States and Iran might actually have some sort of alignment here. Iran wants the United States completely out of the Middle East. That's not going to happen. There are too many allies that depend on the United States, and the United States has far too many interests in the Middle East to try to pull out. But this could be an opening for the president to pull out some other troops and allow NATO service members to go in and take up some of the tasks that the United States has been doing.
Carla Babb reports for the from the Pentagon for VOA. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Anti-government protesters in Iraq have set fires and closed streets during a demonstration against the Iranian missile strike that targeted two military bases housing U.S. troops. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley has more on the global reaction after the attack.
The Iranian attack was in retaliation for a U.S. drone strike that killed top Revolutionary Guard commander General Qasem Soleimani last week near Baghdad airport. U.S. officials have said there are no immediate reports of U.S. casualties. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has condemned the Iranian missile strike and has urged Iran to refrain from further military action. China's foreign ministry is expressing concern about the spike in tensions in the Middle East and says it hopes matters can swiftly cool off. Germany has condemned the Iranian missile attack, and Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer said the government rejects this aggression in the sharpest possible terms. I'm Zaria Shakli.
Germany's largest airline, Lufthansa, on Wednesday said it would resume flights to Tehran on Thursday after earlier canceling its daily flight to the Iranian capital due to the situation in the country. Lufthansa said Tehran's airport was open and that there were no security restrictions for the approach or the surrounding area. AP correspondent Mike Hempen has more on other commercial airlines rerouting flights across the Middle East to avoid potential danger.
Australian carrier Qantas, Malaysia Airlines, and Singapore Airlines all have adjusted their flight schedules to avoid Iranian airspace. Qantas is also staying out of Iraqi airspace. And the Federal Aviation Administration says it's barring American pilots and carriers from flying in areas of Iraqi, Iranian, and some Persian Gulf airspace. The agency warns of the potential for miscalculation or misidentification of civilian aircraft amid heightened tensions between the U.S. and Iran. I'm Mike Hempen.
In what appears to be an unrelated event, a Ukrainian passenger jet carrying 176 people crashed on Wednesday, just minutes after taking off from the Iranian capital's main airport, turning farmland on the outskirts of Tehran into fields of flaming debris and killing all on board. Reuters' Libby Hogan has those details.
A Ukrainian Boeing 737 crashed after takeoff in Iran Wednesday, carrying 176 people. All aboard were killed, according to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Grim footage from Iranian TV showed debris, smoking metal scrap, and rescue workers with face masks retrieving bodies. Officials and Iranian state TV say the plane had technical problems soon after leaving Tehran's Imam Khomeini Airport. The plane crashed near the airport and burst into flames. The flight tracking service Flight Radar 24 showed the plane was flight PS752 bound for Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Iranian state media quoting a local aviation official said the pilot did not declare an emergency. Iranian rescue workers have reported they've now found one of the two black boxes of the crashed airliner. The airline said it's doing everything possible to find out more details about the cause of the crash. The site says the plane was 3 years old and was a 737NG jet. Wednesday's crash could pile into Boeing's safety crisis. It's been grappling with two deadly crashes involving another jet, the 737 MAX. Boeing grounded its 737 MAX fleet worldwide last March. The crash also happened within hours of missile strikes launched from Iran at US-led forces in Iraq. However, the airliner's crash is apparently unrelated to the attack.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan, and you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Data from NASA's new planet-hunting spacecraft, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, has led to its first discovery of a circumbinary planet, or one that orbits two stars. Now called TOI 1338b, the planet was discovered by a high school student who spent last summer as an intern at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. The space agency says that the exoplanet resides in a system 1,300 light-years away in the constellation Pictor, and that the stars orbit each other every 15 days. According to NASA, TOI 1338b is the only planet known to exist in the system. Its size is described as being between that of Neptune and Saturn. TESS finds exoplanets by detecting dips in a star's brightness, signaling that a planet is passing in front of it. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. United Nations officials have expressed alarm at the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Syria's northeast-west province of Idlib. They report neighboring countries have also closed their borders, trapping some 3 million civilians inside Idlib with nowhere to go. Lisa Schlein reports over the past 8 months, they say more than 700,000 people have been displaced by the fighting.
Turkey and other countries have closed their borders with Syria, making it virtually impossible for some 3 million civilians in Idlib to escape the violence. Over the past 8 months, the United Nations says more than 700,000 people have been forced to flee their homes. It says 300,000 of them have become displaced since mid-December. That is when Syrian forces and their Russian allies mounted a fierce onslaught to retake Idlib, the last territory still under rebel control. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says at least 1,300 civilians were killed by airstrikes and shelling between May and August. He says the death toll has certainly risen as airstrikes and shelling are now taking place in many towns and villages on a near daily basis.
Every day we receive disturbing reports of families caught up in the violence, seeking refuge and access to essential services in overcrowded camps and urban areas. Many are now sheltering in schools, mosques, and other public buildings. Across Idlib, we get reports of critical shortages of food, shelter, health, and winterization assistance, as well as other basic services required for their survival.
Layerke says cross-border humanitarian operations mandated by the UN Security Council have kept millions of people across Syria alive since 2014. But he notes the resolution remains in force only until January 10th. He tells VOA keeping aid flowing into Syria across borders is critically important. He says food, water, medicine, and other essential relief is crucial in keeping down the death toll.
Of course, we cannot prevent shelling and fighting. We can call for that to stop. What we can do is that we can provide aid so that people survive where they are during this very harsh winter. And that is what we are doing. As I mentioned, 2.7 million really rely on our assistance for their survival, and we need to see that continue.
The UN continues to call on the warring parties to take all necessary measures to ensure that civilians are protected. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has reiterated his call for an immediate end to the hostilities that have been going on for nearly 9 years. The UN chief says the only way to achieve a credible, lasting peace is through a political process. Despite his heartfelt appeal, it appears for now the warring parties are not listening. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Australia, cooler, damper weather has slowed the brush fires that have already consumed over 10 million hectares of land, displaced tens of thousands of people, and killed nearly a billion animals. However, even those who are safe from fire itself can be harmed by the acrid smoke, which has risen several kilometers high and now has drifted over 11,000 kilometers to South America. To find out more about these epic fires and their possible relationship to climate change, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Robert Field, an associate research scientist at the Columbia University and the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York.
Upwards of 80% of the smoke, on average, from fires in Australia come from northern Australia, which is a tropical savanna where there's a high fire return interval. And within 5 years, the same plot of land can reburn because the vegetation regrows so quickly. And so emissions-wise, in a global climate sense, the initial emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases is offset fairly quickly by regrowing vegetation. One exception is deforestation fires, like we see in the Amazon, for example, or in Indonesia, where there's a lot of fire, and those CO2 emissions are not offset because that land is being converted from forest land into, say, agricultural land. But that's not generally the case in Australia.
Is this the biggest fire on record in Australia?
At a national level, it's unlikely to make this the biggest fire year on record. But what we're seeing in Victoria and New South Wales at a state level, there is an extraordinary amount of fire. To see that number of huge fires at one time in a relatively small area is exceptional.
What's causing this exceptional set of fires?
Up until November, at least, 2019 was among the hottest years on record, which just provides that much more time for the fuels to really dry out. So inevitably, there will be ignitions, lightning, or human-caused accidental fires from a cigarette but to a failed power line when it is that dry, and some of them will get out of control.
What will be the impact of these fires and smoke beyond Australia?
Right now, the smoke from those fires has just passed the dateline. It's headed towards South America, and it's a massive smoke plume. From space, it looks like a small volcanic eruption. The effect of that smoke is still an open question. We know it does something, right? And you can study individual plumes and see, for example, that plume is warming up the air around it. And some of these smoke plumes are dark because the hotter a fire burns, the darker the particulate matter, so it absorbs sunlight. But it's very localized, and whether or not cumulatively, these types of fires have a pronounced climatic effect is very much an open question. As far as the smoke goes, the concern right now is the effects on air quality at the surface. Just having looked at the air quality in Canberra, those are horrible conditions that are quite unusual. Even in a fire-prone country, it's really bad.
Now, zooming back and taking a look at our warming world, do you think we'll be seeing a lot more of these epic fires?
Depending on the part of the world, everywhere will get warmer to varying degrees. For fire, the question is, will that warming be offset by an increase, for example, in precipitation? Just in the simplest sense, the fire danger is a combination of temperature, relative humidity, precipitation, and wind speed from day to day. And so in 50 or 100 years, will the warming that we see, will it be counteracted by more rain? In the western U.S. and in southern Europe, there is not expected to be enough precipitation to offset the warming, and that means more fire.
What's the outlook for Africa?
Southern Africa, South Africa specifically, is very similar to Australia in terms of its fire environment. And that's one place where the temperature increase will not be offset by an increase in precipitation. And that's a robust projection across a lot of different climate models. Similarly to Northern Australia, in savannas, for example, that vegetation regrows quickly, and so that fuel reappears within, say, 5 years. If anything, that's one place where the land use has a direct effect on the amount of fire, whether or not savannas have been converted into pasture, for example. That, to me, will be the main future driving factor of fire in Africa. And in the Sahel and in, say, Angola, the dominant fire will be controlled by future land use as much as climate.
That was Robert Field, an associate research professor at Columbia University and the NASA Goddard Space Institute in New York. He spoke with my colleague Adam Phillips. In addition, singer Elton John pledged on Tuesday to donate $1 million to help those affected by the Australian brush fires.
To see what is happening here breaks my heart. And so we have to come together and we have to fight. And this is my bit towards it. And I love Australia so much. And to those who've lost their homes, God bless. I hope that your lives will be repaired very, very soon.
It wasn't immediately clear if the musicians' donations would be in Australian or U.S. dollars. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Wednesday that Washington's backing for Israel's settlements in the occupied West Bank will advance Israeli-Palestinian peace, angering Palestinian leaders who seek the territory for a state. Speaking by video link at a Jerusalem policy forum dubbed the Pompeo Doctrine, Mr. Pompeo, in a recorded statement, said the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump returned to a balanced and sober approach to the Middle East peace by changing its position. In a reversal of 4 decades of U.S. policy, Pompeo in November announced that the United States no longer viewed Israel's settlements on the West Bank land it captured in the 1967 Mideast War as inconsistent with international law. Palestinians and the international community view the transfer of any country's civilians to occupied land as illegal under the 4th Geneva Convention of 1949 and UN Security Council resolutions. Many countries condemn the announcement. The move delighted Israel and provides important U.S. support amid a potential international criminal court inquiry into alleged war crimes in Palestinian areas, including the West Bank. Nissan's fugitive ex-boss Carlos Ghosn on Wednesday described his arrest in Japan, from in which he escaped last month, as a plot against him, and his detention conditions as a travesty against human rights.
Thanks to the systematic leaking of false information and distorted information, and the intentional withholding of exculpatory information by the prosecutor and by Nissan, I was presumed guilty before the eyes of the world and subject to a system whose only objective is to coerce confessions, secure guilty pleas without regard to the truth.
The former auto industry executive dismissed all allegations against him as untrue, saying that he should have never been arrested in the first place. Ghosn slipped out of Japan last month and arrived in Beirut. Lebanese authorities have said Ghosn entered the country on a legal passport. Lebanon and Japan do not have an extradition treaty, and an Interpol arrest notice does not require Lebanon to do so. Ghosn's former employer, Nissan Motor Company, said it was still pursuing legal action against him despite the escape, adding that Ghosn engaged in serious misconduct while leading the Nissan-Renault-Mitsubishi alliance. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, engineer Justin Thwaites, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. You can visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. And you can also find archive copies of the show on the program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.